He's been writing on jazz for more than 20 years. He was once editor of Downbeat, Jazz Magazine, and Metronome, author of a book called Jazz People. He's currently vice president and trustee of NARIS, and has won 3 Grammy Awards for liner notes. His subject this morning will be the Institute for Jazz Studies, Dan Morgenstern.
Thank you, Tim. Can you hear me?
No.
Can you hear me now? Yes. Can you hear it now? All right. The Institute of Jazz Studies is located on one of the several Rutgers campuses in New Jersey, this one in Newark. As some of you might not know, Rutgers is the State University of New Jersey, and it has it's scattered all over the state. Mainly, it's around New Brunswick, and there's also one in Camden, and it's sort of like a feudal system of various colleges and universities. It was once cited in a sociological study of bureaucracies as having all the features of state universities plus private universities and other things that could turn into bureaucratic nightmares, and I think that's to some extent is true, my experience there. However, Rutgers had the foresight to acquire the Institute in 1966 when the late Professor Marshall Stearns had realized that he no longer could operate the Institute as a private institution. Marshall Stearns, as some of you may know, was one of the first and foremost serious jazz scholars in this country. It was an avocational pursuit, as it has been historically for most people involved in the jazz field until quite recently. Stearns' profession, his field, his professional field, was medieval English literature. He was a Chaucerian and taught at various distinguished universities, including Hunter College in New York. But while he was an undergraduate at Yale, he became interested in jazz, and he was one of the founders of the United Hot Clubs of America, an organization which, in conjunction with Milt Gabler's Commodore Music Shop, began the first series of systematic jazz reissues in this country. Marshall was a saver. He started keeping archives early on when he began to do his research in jazz history. And by the time he formally founded the Institute in 1952, he had amassed a very respectable collection, a unique feature of which was that it had so many components. Most of us private collectors tend to collect one thing or another. We collect records, or we collect magazines, or we collect photographs, or whatever it might be. But Marshall kept everything. So it was a marvelous collection, and it was housed at, he had one of those big old apartments in Greenwich Village in New York, many rooms, and one room there on Waverly Place was the Institute, floor to ceiling, shelves with records and books and so on. I should also say that Marshall's interests went beyond strictly jazz. He was very interested in the roots of jazz and frequently traveled to the Caribbean. He eventually also went to Africa, and he collected things from his journeys there. And the library, which became the core of the library of the Institute, included a number of interesting materials dealing with Afro-American studies and sociology and various other aspects of the field, including jazz fiction. We have quite a nice collection of ephemeral things of usually a very modest literary value, but quite interesting as cultural documents. For instance, paperbacks from the 50s. One of my favorites is one called Jazz Bum, They're quite marvelous. We recently had at Rutgers a major conference on urban literature in the United States, and we put together a little display of these things, which amused some of the literati a great deal. To an extent, before I travel too far afield, this was an excellent collection, and Marshall made it available mainly on weekends and during certain evening hours while the Institute was at his home. He had a curator and right-hand man, Sheldon Harris, who, as some of you may know, recently published a major reference work called The Blues Who's Who, which he's been working on for some 18 years, starting during his affiliation with the Institute. However, it soon became clear to Marshall that once he had made the Institute an official organization, which was, as I said, in 1952, and had started to actively solicit materials from record companies and book publishers and so on, it began to grow, and it grew, and eventually it went beyond the confines of what could be run as a kind of semi-private institution. So he began to shop around for institutional affiliation, and first he offered it to Yale, and Yale didn't want it, and then he offered it to various black colleges, and some of them were interested, but nothing really came of it. In the long run, he didn't feel that they would be able to support it because the interest was generally located in one or two people, but not in the administration. So, to make a long story short, Rutgers did accept it and accepted Marshall's conditions, which could be summarized as the three A's. We call it the three A's. It has nothing to do with the triple A. These three A's being autonomy, accessibility, and acquisitions. Autonomy, because Marshall knew enough about the way universities work to realize that a university might take the Institute and be very grateful and then absorb it into some existing music library or simply put it in a basement somewhere, make it inaccessible and discontinue any kind of attempts to continue to obtain materials and so on. So autonomy was number one. Accessibility was number two. Again, Marshall did not feel, and I think all of us who have been involved in the Institute since then share his feelings, that it would make any sense to make this a kind of rare book collection or something which would be available only to people who could show a long list of credentials and letters of introduction and, you know, stamps and so on and so forth. He felt that it should be available to the field, simply for the reason that so at that time, certainly, so little was available to jazz scholars and jazz students. And we continue in that tradition. We'll come back to that later on. And the third A, acquisitions, a minimum commitment, at least, on the part of the university to keep the archives current, that is to subscribe at least to major periodicals, attempt to obtain major publications, and a modest amount of recordings that would not be available through donations from manufacturers. So it came to Rutgers in 1966. Unfortunately, Marshall Stearns died very shortly after the papers were signed and everything. So what normally would have been an orderly period of transition turned out to be a very abrupt one because Mrs. Stearns did not wish to stay in New York for any length of time. She wanted to get out, move to Florida, and she told Rutgers, here it is, you take it. No, I want to get rid of it. So the Rutgers people didn't have time to prepare for adequate placement of the Institute, and it was put in the basement of the main library on the Rutgers campus in Newark, Dana Library, where it rested for some time. And some of you from the area who might have gone out there during those years to consult the archives would have found, this long before I had any connection with it, but I went out there too a few times, and you may have found that very little really was accessible. There was a minimal amount of stuff accessible, and the staffing was also quite minimal. But a few dedicated people at Rutgers, mostly on their own time, managed to keep keep it running, managed also to acquire important materials, and also managed to solicit donations for the Institute of collections and so on. And during this kind of semi-dormant period, certain important things did happen. George Hafer, some of you may know who remember who George Hafer was, a longtime contributor to Downbeat, who started a collector's column there in 1939 called The Hot Box, and a pioneer jazz researcher, left all his research files to the Institute, and that almost doubled a very important component of the collection, which we are very proud of, which is our research files, which are basically divided into two segments, a topics file with a various subject headings, and an artist or individual file. Both of these operate somewhat along the order of a newspaper morgue, and each individual folder or folders, because in some cases we have like an Ellington or Armstrong, several miles of stuff, clippings from newspapers and periodicals, promotional materials, publicity materials, all kinds of things pertaining to an individual or a subject, and those are very useful. So Hafer's stuff came to the Institute. Various people who moved to California left behind some of their things, Leonard Feather, Orrin Keepnews, and others from the jazz community who at that time, there was kind of an exodus to the West Coast. So it continued to grow. And then in the early 70s, Rutgers Newark acquired a building on the Newark campus, which happened to be a factory building, not very beautiful, but quite large. And that became the arts building of Rutgers Newark, and the people who had been looking after the Institute's interest at that time made the necessary moves to get the Institute space there. So there was an area of somewhat over 5,000 square feet, which became the Institute, and for the first time, it was possible to get all the materials up, get them all sorted out, and make them all accessible. And since then, I'm pleased to say the holdings in terms of records and so on have increased considerably, and we are in a process of fairly continuous growth. Most of this comes from donations from private collectors. Unfortunately, most of these things come to us when someone dies, and but that's nature's way, and can't be helped. We do make an effort to obtain materials from record companies and from book publishers. We have more luck usually with the record companies. In part also because we do a weekly radio program over National Public Radio Station in Newark, WBGO, and that enhances the tendency to give us promotional copies of records. We do well with the major record companies. The smaller companies, in some cases, can't be expected to give away things, but they do usually make them available to us at distributors or dealers' rates. Periodicals, we presently subscribe to approximately 65 periodicals from all over the world, and that also you just manage. I should say here that the budget we get from the university acquisitions budget is very modest, and so is the operational budget in general. I quickly discovered when I came to the Institute in 1976 that the only way to really get it on its, well, not on its feet, because it was on its feet, but to get it to grow and to obtain some recognition within the university itself would be to try to get grants. And grants-funded projects are really the only way to build staff and to keep things going. And At present, we have two major grants funded projects. One with which some of you will be familiar is the computerized cataloging project of the record collection at the Institute. And I have, there is material on this. Anyone who is particularly interested in this, and it gets a little technical to describe exactly what is being done there, we'll be glad to send you materials on this. We have the good fortune that our librarian, Marie Griffin, is an expert in this area and someone who loves cataloging. To those of you who are librarians, you will know that exists. To others, it may seem strange that someone really love cataloging, but she does, and it's great. She has enormous enthusiasm, and she's very resourceful, and she has been responsible, I think, really, for bringing this project to the point where it is and has made a considerable contribution to the developing MARC format of the Library of Congress, machine-readable, that means, and other settings of bibliographic standards for the cataloging of vernacular music, which has been sort of a stepchild in the library community. We work on this in close cooperation with other archives, with Rodgers and Hammerstein, with the people in Nashville at the Country Music Foundation, also with the Big Three, we have found this to be a very rewarding project, not only for ourselves, because it makes access to our own collection that much easier, although it does take time, it's slow going, but also because of the interest that it has generated in the library community. The other project is the Jazz Oral History Project, which is funded by National Endowment for the Arts, and which resided for some time at the Smithsonian Institution. It left the Smithsonian because Congress and its wisdom decided that it wasn't proper for a federally funded project to be in an institution which also relied heavily on federal funding. And this is how it got to go away from the Smithsonian and come to us, but we were, needless to say, very happy to get it. We were also able to provide a somewhat better access to it in terms of making it accessible to researchers. The oral history it rests on the premise that a good in-depth interview with a musician should consist of at least 5 usable hours on tape. Tape that is of reasonably good audio quality, and almost close to 100 musicians have been interviewed up to this time. The interviewees receive a subject fee, which is quite respectable, but that was the desire of the National Endowment for the Arts Jazz Program, that in a sense these interviews would amount to a kind of recognition of the contribution that these people have made to the music, and therefore that is something which makes it a little different from the average oral history project and causes it to proceed at a slightly slower pace because the money, of course, has to be there to pay the interviewees. We have a little brochure. Some of you may have picked up already, but we've got more here for those of you who are interested, which lists alphabetically most of the people who have been interviewed. The most, really most recent ones are not in here, but it's quite a respectable cross-section of major and minor but important jazz figures. These materials are transcribed, edited for errors and so on. A copy of the transcript is then given to the musician to check for accuracy, also to the interviewer to look over, and then the musician is entitled to restrict certain aspects of the transcript for reasons of confidentiality, although we don't run into that too often. A lot of really interesting and important material has been uncovered through this process. The transcripts are available to anyone, qualified researchers, which is a term that we use, which really means anyone who has a legitimate reason to consult these transcripts. They can only be quoted from and directly quoted from in, you know, somewhat limited ways, but they are available as a resource to the field. And we hope that in the future that there may be copies available in other centers of jazz research and scholarship. And this is an ongoing program. Unfortunately, even though the cuts that are being made by the current administration in the endowment funding, we still have reason to believe that this particular program will continue to be funded at least for the next few years. Other things we have at the Institute that may be of interest, of course, the core of a whole thing, in a sense, is the collection of records and tapes. We have operative close to 60,000 items by now, about 35 to 40,000 78s, some 15,000 LPs, and about 3 to 4,000 transcriptions, acetates, and so on. We define jazz rather broadly. Unlike a comparable archive, there are very few comparable places. There are libraries, of course, that have holdings in jazz which may be much larger than ours, such as the Library of Congress, but they're not uniquely, you know, accessible in the way that ours are. And there may be other places that have certain things that we have or that have more of them, but again, the combination of components that we have is rather unique. In any case, we define as our area of interest certain areas of folk music that had an impact on jazz. Needless to say, all African, West African, and Caribbean bluegrass, and since the word hillbilly, which I thought was off limits, has been made respectable here during this convention, that kind of materials. Jazz-influenced dance music of the 20s, early ragtime performances and later ragtime performances as well, even certain areas of musical comedy, popular song, and so on, everything that has some relevance to jazz as a whole. And needless to say, everything in jazz from the original Dixieland Jazz Band to Albert Eiler and the latest electronic experiments, whatever. Needless to say, also, it's hard to keep up with everything that comes up. We have to be selective. Not everything that comes out is something that we can, at the moment, get a hold of. And at the same time, we're also backtracking and trying to fill gaps and so on. But the collection is quite comprehensive. We do not have the luxury of all the technical, wonderful playback and re-recording systems that we saw the other day here. This is an area in which I hope to be able to raise some money for acquisition so that we can get this to the point where we can do some of our own quality re-recording of materials that are very scarce and perishable and rare. At the moment, what we have done with some of our rarer items is simply that we have made reasonably decent transfers to the tape, and so that we don't have to play them. At some later date, we hope to, you know, do better. We do have fairly decent Revox and a nice Nakamichi cassette recorder and so on. And we're able to perform services to the field in terms of reference recording and so on. We do work with record companies. Quite frequently they may come to us when they have a reissue project and they can't find source material. We also work with projects like the Time Life Giants of Jazz series, primarily in the preparation of reference cassettes for them, because their consultants for any given project may come in with as many as 150 or 160 suggestions, from which they then narrow it down to 36 or 40. But we put everything on a reference cassette for them, and then they go through it and then tell us what it is that they want. Needless to say, the actual source material in most cases does not come from us. We are also about to enter into an agreement with Franklin Mint Society. They want to do what they call a definitive history of jazz on records. Some of you may have seen the country music series that they have just begun to advertise now, which is being done in conjunction with the Country Music Foundation. These things are what they are. They have their limitations since they are aimed at a mass audience. However, I believe it is possible to do quality work. And unlike Time Life, who have their own boards of in-house experts or would-be experts, and who do a lot of what we're being recorded here, but they unnecessary nitpicking in terms of the selections and so on. Franklin Mint do not pretend to be experts, and they will leave most of the decision making to us, which is good. So we hope to come up with something decent. Some of you may be interested in the fact that we recently acquired some rather outstanding collections of materials, and one of them we acquired in an interesting way, which shows that cooperation between institutions is something which is not just an abstract ideal, but which can actually happen sometimes. The University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, had some years ago, as a matter of fact, some 15 or 16 years ago, received a large collection of 78 recordings and transcriptions and acetates and various other things, most of it jazz, from a pediatrician named John Dale Owen, a resident of Milwaukee who at that time decided to move to New Mexico. The collection simply sat in a basement there at Wisconsin. Nobody knew what to do with it. They didn't have the facilities to transfer it or to even play the transcription materials. There was no jazz program within which this could fit. And it just so happened that Marie Griffin at the American Library Association meeting gave a little presentation about the Institute. The music librarian of University of Wisconsin happened to be there. He had for many years thought that it was a shame that this stuff was sitting there and not being used for anything. So, again, to make a long story short, with the cooperation of his boss and with cooperation of some people at Rutgers who came up with the money for transporting the stuff, it had to be, needless to say, packed very well and so on. We got this collection on a permanent loan basis, which simply means that sometime in the future, if Milwaukee ever wants it back, they can have it back, but they'll have to pay for, transporting it back. It's very unlikely that they ever will. We have certain responsibilities in maintaining it and so on, which is only right and proper. But it's a very, very interesting collection. Dr. Owens had access to a local radio station, and a lot of direct offline transcriptions were done for him of a lot of Ellington stuff and other things. He also, according to the papers that we got with the collection, was an advisor to the VDisc program, but But we were never able to find anybody in who had worked on the V-Disc project who had heard of him, including George Simon and other people. He's not mentioned in the Sears book. But we managed to find out how he came to be an advisor to the V-Disc project. He performed some kind of operation, delicate delivery or something for a general's wife, and general asked him, "What can I do for you, Doc?" And he said, "Well, get me access to this V-Disc stuff." And so that's what happened. And I think he also, with all, you know, due respect to him, he did function in some sort of advisory capacity as well. However, he did get V-Disc tests and session acetates and quite a lot of unissued stuff there. Not all of it jazz by any means, also things of interest in other areas of music. And when we get all this stuff really sorted out, we intend to get in touch with those of you whom we know would be interested in some of these other things or in documenting them. The transcription material ranges widely, and it's not, it will take us some time to go through it and really figure out what everything is. We have been able to identify some interesting Ellington stuff, and some of which is known to exist in other configurations, but maybe in better sound, the stuff that we have. The other collection which came to us recently was that of the late Albert H. McVitie. Mr. McVitie, who was a resident of Princeton, went to Princeton University and is mentioned in Jazz Men as one of the earliest known group of jazz, serious jazz record collectors in this country. His classmates included people like Squirrel Ashcraft, who also died recently, by the way, and Bill Priestley, and McVitie, unlike those people, Priestley and Ashcraft were mostly interested in Bix and Trumbar, Red Nichols, and you know, the white bands. But McVitie developed an early interest and fascination for blues, so he went out and got Paramounts and Black Swans and all kinds of things, when one could do that, you know, and continued to collect throughout his life. What we got, approximately close to 4,078s and over 1,000 LPs, and of excellent quality. However, he did play his collection. He was one of those people who didn't put the records away in cellophane, but he played them. So they're not by any means all mint, but there's some very good stuff there. We have, among other things, also a collection of antique phonographs in working condition, including cylinder players and an Edison Diamond Disc reproducer and a Pathé Hill and Dale producer. And in terms of what was said yesterday at that very interesting colloquium, I agree that it's almost impossible you know, for us today to try to hear things the way they were heard, you know, 50, 80, 100 years ago. But the one thing that struck me when, you know, when we're checking out these things is that the Edison Diamond Discs played on that Edison Diamond Disc machine sound remarkably fine. Even the acoustics sound marvelous. It's really astonishing what a difference that makes when you hear them like that. That's the one exception I would make to what I otherwise agree is you know, an abstract ideal. Anyway, it's was one of Stearns's ideas too, to have machines in working condition that would be able to play every possible configuration of old recordings. A collection of cylinders, not very impressive, but then again, there is very little cylinder material that is directly jazz related. We also have a collection of piano rolls and a player piano in working condition. We have memorabilia. We have Willie the Lion Smith's bowler hat and a straw hat that belonged to Kid Ory. That's the hat collection. We also have the tenor saxophones of Lester Young, who is presently on loan to the Smithsonian for their bicentennial exhibit, the one that Lester made all those Basie, wonderful Basie records on, and Ben Webster's treasured Selmer, known as Old Betsy, with the last read in it that Ben had. And those, when we get Lester's horn back from the Smithsonian, we're going to put them together in a special display case, because those two guys were good friends, and I think they would like that idea. We have Pee-wee Russell's, one of Pee-wee Russell's clarinets, and we have most of Pee-wee Russell's paintings. In a minute, I'll show you one of those. Pee-wee became a painter late in life and produced a remarkable series of canvases, and we have some 40 of these, which we hope to put to some kind of use one day. We have some rare manuscripts. We have a typescript of Louis Armstrong's Satchmo, My Life in New Orleans. And if you read that and then compare it to what came out, it's really a shame what those editors did with it. And maybe someday we can publish that. We are looking to start a series of annual publications of the oral history materials, selected things from the oral history materials, plus maybe occasional discographies and so on, in collaboration with Scarecrow Press. Some of you may be aware of Scarecrow Press, a small house that does mainly scholarly books. We also publish the Journal of Jazz Studies, which is a semi-annual, or supposed to be a semi-annual publication. Doesn't always work out that way. It has been paying for itself. It's really the work of two dedicated people who have other things to do. David Kayer, who is the director of sponsored research at Rutgers, and Chuck Nanry, who is the dean of Newark College of Arts and Sciences. They're the co-editors. It has sort of paid for itself, and with printing costs and everything skyrocketing, and the future of the journal is, well, we hope that we can manage to continue it. In any case, it is the only English language scholarly journal devoted to the subject of jazz. And let's see, what else have we got? Well, let me show you. How much time have I got left, Tim?
Not a lot.
Not a lot. Okay. Well, I want to show you some. I will take you on an imaginary tour of the institute. Can we dim the lights or something? This is let me do it this way. This is the reading room. As you come in, we have a large room which sort of serves a lot of functions. That is a reading room. It's also a reception area, and some of the individual offices branch off from there. This is a staged photograph, I must admit. But usually people come and work there, and we have several here who have used our facilities. This is the player piano. It works, and on top of it, you'll see, among other things, the little statuette of Louis is generally available, but the other thing up there is a sculpture of Charlie Parker done from life by a lady named Julie McDonald. Those of you who know the Bob Reisner book, Parker will know about that. And on the piano itself there in front is the Lester Young's certification of the tenor saxophone I mentioned before. This is our trusted secretary, Miss Jeanette Gale, in the vertical files, the research files. And you know this fellow here is looking at a DECA race record pamphlet there. This is a segment of our reference section there in the library. It's Jepson up there, and all the other stuff. We have a lot of, we try to keep up with all the discographic literature. Brunix is up on top there. Those of you who know Brunix will know what a pain in the whatever that is, but it's a necessary thing to have. This is a computer terminal, and being input there is a, what is that, a cameo? I think it's a cameo, yeah. And In the cataloging project, of course, nothing is put in there unless the disc has been physically examined and in some most cases also listened to, and we have discovered unknown alternates of very unimportant and insignificant recordings. Oops. Oh, I wanted to skip that anyway. That is Ron Welburn, our project coordinator for the oral history, and listening to an interview and making notes. I go back to, this is a microfiche reader. The indexes, cumulative indexes to the cataloging are being generated in microfiche form, and they are available at cost by subscription. Those of you who are interested in that, I'd be glad to tell you about it. Let me skip forward to Ron. And here is Marie Griffin, and those are this part of the stacks of the 78s. We have recently been able to get all the 78s out of that awful metal industrial shelving, and we've had some more made of these wooden bins there, which are much better. As I said before, now if we had a lot of money, we would be able to do a lot of things, but you have to do them gradually. At least we got the 78s out of those metal things, which are horrible, but we still have to keep most of the LPs in that type of shelving. But one of these days. That is one of our assistant curators. That was another collection that we got of some excellent, more or less current LPs, most of them imports, and he is going through them, logging them into the shelf list, and looking quite pleased about it. There's a longer view of Mr. Kensler at his task there. In the back there, everything is always in a state of flux because records come in and are being cataloged. And it will look awfully primitive to those of you who have the luxury of very high-class operations. But we manage in our own bumbling way. That is Ed Berger, our curator and resident Benny Carter expert, and that is the Pathé Hill and Dale that he's demonstrating there. Well, next to it is one of those big gold-filled Columbias. And in the back, behind Ed, is a lampophone. Are you familiar with lampophones? Sound is horrible, but they're very intriguing. And every time, collector types who come to visit us, when they see we have two lampophones, and those are the ones they always want. That's yours truly, once again, with a part of the piano roll collection. And I don't know, I look like I had been nightclubbing the night before or something. Cylinders behind me there. And those are the cylinders, some of them. And in front of that, this is sort of a still life that the photographer put together, a trumpet donated by Miles Davis. The mouthpiece. that combination might sort of sum up the Institute in a way that, everything from Thomas to Miles there. The mouthpiece, by the way, is not Miles's. That's a mouthpiece that belongs to Roy Eldridge with rhinestones. Never used it. This is one of Pee-wee's paintings. This one is called The Prisoner. I think the titles of most of these, it's also upside down, I'm sorry to say, but since it is abstract, it doesn't matter so much. But you can see the signature up in the corner there. Pee-wee's things, I think, are quite remarkable insofar as when he started painting, he'd never been to a museum or a gallery. All he knew about painting was he'd seen some of his friend George Wetling's work. Wetling, of course, studied with Stuart Davis, but Pee-wee had quite a knack for this. But the titles, I think, were mostly given to the paintings by his wife. Anyway, this one is called The Prisoner. Here is one of our two copies. We have since obtained a better copy of Tremonesha, of the original Joplin-published version. That one is in pretty good shape except for the cover, but this is out of our taping facilities there. That's Vincent Pilote, who is another assistant curator. He's listening to... It's got Fletcher Henderson on his lap, but that's not a Columbia on the turntable. It looks like a Blue Note or I don't know what. Photo of Charlie Parker in the back, courtesy of... Any others? Morty?
You indicate that you cover the complete spectrum of jazz, contemporary and classic. With all of the things that have been issued in recent years and the limitations of what has already transpired pre-war, if we can use that term again, how do you cope with the extensiveness of the modern stuff and cataloging it and taking care of all of that in relation to the other?
Well, it's a constant struggle to keep up with everything that comes up. We, in terms of what we can obtain, you'd find that, interestingly enough, in terms of the small labels, some of the very modern labels, you know, people like India Navigation and so on, are very forthcoming because they feel the responsibility to their artists to have this stuff come to us where it will be kept, you know, for posterity, so to speak. But there is an enormous amount of material, especially coming out in Europe and all over the place. We try to rely, in part we rely on what we can get, you know, as donations from the companies. What we can't get and what we identify as being of critical importance and what we use for those, you know, the criterion for that is our own knowledge, and we rely on other people who are specialists in various areas and on reviews, reliable reviews in the press and so on, in the specialist press. And then we try to get them. But you can't conceivably keep up with everything. However, much of it also is redundant. There's a lot of, you know, reissuing going on, of unless it happens to be of a spectacular sonic quality or with particularly excellent notes or things like that. We don't necessarily have to get it because we already have it in six other configurations. Although ideally we would want to have everything, you know, just as a historical record. Any other? Dan?
I know you're awfully short on people and money out there and time and everything else, but is there a possibility, maybe in a future grant, of doing some kind of... Total, maybe computerized catalog of the printed holdings, particularly the comparing up perhaps the oral interview project with some of the older magazine interview material and that kind of stuff.
That's something that we've been thinking seriously about, and in fact, we probably shouldn't give it away, so well, somebody else might jump in and do. But the more, the merrier, and there's an enormous amount of work to be done. We do want to try to get a grant to index at least the major American periodicals, like the early Downbeats, a Downbeat from its inception to 1960 when it became self-indexing. There's a great need for that, but it's complicated. If any of you know old Downbeats, you know how much information there was in there, and it will have to be done by someone who knows how to do it, so you don't just go by an entry, you know, for a headline, which might have nothing to do with the substance of the piece. But these things are things that we would like to become involved in, and the computers, of course, are helpful in this.
As you may have noticed from my grimace up front and from my column, I'm not too enamored with the concept of the Franklin Institute's recordings, their proof quality pressings, and the exorbitant overpricing. I haven't spoken to the, you know, the country music people on it, but what is the arrangement they make with you guys in doing this? Would they be paying you well? Because they, the records are much, much, much more expensive than they should be. And they're, well, it's just like their ingots. They're overpriced just because they will become heirlooms that you can give your children.
Yeah, well, right. We have nothing to do with, you know, their price structure and whatever. Obviously, I'm not going to give you a detailed answer to, you know, a party question. But, yes, they are making it worthwhile for us to participate in this. Also, I don't think the pricing is necessarily exorbitant. People who buy these things fall into two categories, I think. First are the ones who care about the music. The other, and much larger number probably, are people who collect things. They like the, you know, the tooled binding. They like the red transparent vinylite. It's a collectible. And if they are willing and able to pay a certain price for that, then okay. It's not necessarily that exorbitant. I think, you know, when you consider what mail order places charge, you know, that Book of the Month Club, which seems to be very reasonable, whenever you order it, you know, what do you think is a cheap record from them? They add postage and handling, and by the time you get one of their $2 records, it costs you $4.50, you know, so there's, you know, hidden things here and there.
Yeah, well, they also charge us.
We wouldn't get involved with them if we thought that they were, you know, ripping off people. I don't think they are. I mean, they seem to have a fairly, you know, decent standard of quality and so on. And they seem to be nice people to work with. We're just about to start on that, so give you another report next year.
And as you point out, it's a lot better than being second guessed by Time Life as to what ought to go in a classic set.
Right, right. That's very true.
That's really an important. But that's a very sore subject, as you know. It's the selection of those Time Life jazz albums, as far as I'm concerned, and there's some agreement on this, is just inexcusable.
Anybody else? If not, thank you again for your time.
I feel like I'm pushing culture. But we must go on to the next presentation and final presentation. I would first remind those of you who may not have been here for the opening this morning that this afternoon, during the collector's